CD.
Oh, shit, yeah.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, we remember slavery as John Ashcroft, a man who opposed desegregation in Missouri and praised the leaders of the Confederacy as patriots, starts his first day of work as Bush's Attorney General. Also, Walden Bello speaks to us from the World Social Forum in Brazil about globalization and the growing movement against it. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A sharply divided Senate yesterday confirmed John Ashcroft as Attorney General with a 58-42 vote. All 50 Senate Republicans plus 8 Democrats backed Ashcroft, while 42 of 50 Senate Democrats opposed him. This gave Democrats one more vote than was needed to mount a filibuster or procedural delay to block the nomination. But Democrats decided instead to use their nearly united front against Ashcroft as a warning to Bush that he can expect an even tougher fight if he ever offers another such conservative nominee. During his tenure as Missouri's Attorney General, Ashcroft fought against a voluntary school desegregation plan, as well as legislation designed to equalize access to voter registration in St. Louis, which is 50% African American. As a senator, he authored legislation providing for a constitutional amendment declaring that life begins at fertilization, which would have banned all abortions and even some forms of contraception. He also led a successful battle to deny a federal judgeship to Ronnie White, Missouri's first black Supreme Court judge. At his swearing-in ceremony, Ashcroft used 3 Bibles for his oath of office, 1 for each of his children. California Governor Gray Davis yesterday signed a $10 billion package designed to ease the state's power crunch. The legislation allows the state to sell bonds and use the money to sign long-term contracts with energy wholesalers who've allowed prices to soar in an attempt to provide power-starved California and its cash-strapped utilities with reliable and affordable energy sources for as long as a decade. But residents still face the prospect of rate hikes. The measure allows the California Public Utilities Commission to raise electricity rates to repay the state for its power purchases. Another provision, designed to encourage conservation, would penalize residential customers with higher rates if they consume 30% more energy than a baseline specified by regional climate and energy use. Republican Assemblyman Rod Paccio said it's an unlimited rate increase, and there's no question about that. That's Assemblyman Rod Paccio. Less than a week before the Israeli election, left-wing peace advocates in Israel have become the latest group to take up the debate on whether to cast blank ballots in protest against the 2 candidates for prime minister. Asher Aryan, a senior fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute in Jerusalem, said, "I think it's the first time in Israel electoral history, certainly among Jews, that the idea of non-voting has become a way to express a political opinion." He says about a quarter of Jewish voters are still undecided, not just about who to vote for, but whether to vote. Some analysts believe the country, where 90% of people normally go to the polls, could see an unprecedented low turnout on Tuesday. 4 months of fighting between Israeli troops and Palestinians has further hardened the left's view of Prime Minister Ehud Barak as a leader who didn't try hard enough to reach a peace deal with the Palestinians. Barak's opponent is right-wing Likud party leader Ariel Sharon, a former Israeli general who is scorned by many for his violent stance in regard to the conflict with the Palestinians. He maintains a double-digit lead over Barak in the polls. Israel's Arab minority is also struggling with the issue of whether casting a blank ballot would send the strongest message. They're angered by the deaths in October of 13 Israeli Arabs killed by Israeli police fire and anti-government protests. Analysts say without the Arab vote, which makes up 18% of the electorate, Barak cannot win the election. And Russian and other immigrant voters also appear unenthusiastic about heading to the polls. The latest survey of immigrant voters showed only 58% were planning to vote. This news from the United Nations facing mounting criticism that its sanctions hit innocent civilians the hardest. The UN Security Council is considering changing the way it imposes such punishments. The proposals include mandatory time limits, a partial easing of embargoes to reward what the Security Council considers good behavior, and UN punishment for countries that trade with countries under sanctions. Ambassadors decided to launch the reform effort to answer critics who say decade-old sanctions on Iraqis are hurting innocent civilians. They're also reacting to reports of large-scale violations of diamond embargoes against rebels who sell gems to fund their wars in Angola and Sierra Leone. The draft report is still under negotiation, and the United States has made clear it has problems with several of the most dramatic changes suggested, apparently fearing that they could challenge the hardline U.S. position on Iraq.
Consummation of grief. I even hear the mountains, the way they laugh, up and down their blue sides. And down in the water, the fish cry, and all the water is their tears. I listen to the water on nights I drink away, and the sadness becomes so great. I hear it in my clock. It becomes knobs upon my dresser. It becomes paper on the floor. Becomes a shoehorn, a laundry ticket. It becomes cigarette smoke climbing a chapel of dark vines. It matters little. Very little love is not so bad, or very little life. What counts is waiting on walls. I was born for this. I was born to hustle roses down the avenues of the dead.
Consummation of Grief by Charles Bukowski here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, on the second day of African American History Month, Attorney General John Ashcroft starts work as the nation's top law enforcement official. The ironies are strong. As Missouri Attorney General and Governor, Ashcroft staunchly opposed school desegregation ordered by federal courts in St. Louis and Kansas City, and opposed a voluntary city suburb desegregation plan in St. Louis. 2 years ago, he gave the commencement address at Bob Jones University, which at the time banned interracial dating and other racially discriminatory policies. In 1999, Ashcroft led a deceptive campaign to block the federal judicial nomination of Judge Ronnie White, the first African-American judge on the Missouri State Supreme Court. And in 1998, John Ashcroft gave a long interview to Southern Partisan, a white supremacist magazine. Southern Partisan's merchandising operation has offered a T-shirt celebrating the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. In Ashcroft's interview with the pro-Confederacy publication, he praised Southern Partisan, saying that it, quote, helps set the record straight. You've got a heritage of doing that, of defending Southern patriots like Robert E. Lee, General Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson, and Jefferson Davis. Traditionalists must do more, Ashcroft said. I've got to do more. We've all got to stand up and speak in this respect, or else we'll be taught that these people were giving their lives, subscribing their sacred fortunes and their honor to some perverted agenda, end quote. The men Ashcroft called patriots were all strong defenders of slavery. In this African American History Month, we look at the real legacy of the Confederacy and slavery, one of degradation, pain, and the tragedy that spans centuries. For the next two segments, we'll listen to selections from Remembering Slavery, the voices of those who felt the whips of slavery. This is a Smithsonian production of the original voices of former slaves. Millions of Americans have read the works of literature, from the autobiography of Frederick Douglass to Beloved, that attempt to portray life under slavery. But only a few people alive today have heard the actual voices of men and women who experienced those dark days firsthand. These are historic recordings that were done by interviewers from the Federal Writers Project early in the 1930s, who combed the South in search of former slaves. The interviewers included Zora Neale Hurston and John Lomax, who spoke with hundreds of elderly people about their experiences in slavery and preserved the voices of some on primitive recording devices. The nearly inaudible recordings were placed in the Library of Congress and have never been heard before by a wider public. Now, with the collaboration of the Library of Congress and Smithsonian Productions, the recordings have been remastered and are being presented for the first time. We now go to Remembering Slavery. African Americans talk about their personal experiences of slavery and emancipation.
We were slaves. We belong to people.
See, the white folks would have church in the morning, then they'd let the colored people have church at their church in the evening.
That's your slavery.
In slave time.
I can remember when the Yankees come through.
Well, now, they tell me to a year before the folk know they were free.
See, the old master come in so quickly. He quit praying and then asked the Lord, have mercy on the old master. Lord, have mercy on the old master. Old master was whooping with a bullet whoop.
If I thought that I'd ever be a slave again, I'd take a gun and just end it all right away. Because you're nothing but a dog. You're not a thing but a dog.
From Smithsonian Productions, Remembering Slavery. Those who survived tell their stories. My name is Tonia Stewart. When I was a little girl, about 5 or 6 years old, I used to sit on the garret, the front porch, in the Mississippi Delta. The front porch was called a garret, and listen to Papa Dallas. He was blind and had these ugly scars around his eyes. One day I asked Papa Dallas what happened to his eyes. "Well, daughter," he answered, "when I was mighty young, just about your age, I used to steal away under a big oak tree, and I tried to learn my alphabets so that I could learn to read my Bible. But one day, the overseer caught me, and he drug me out on the plantation, and he called out for all the field hands. And he turned to them and said, 'Let this be a lesson to all of you darkies. You ain't got no right to learn to read.' And then, daughter, he whooped me. And he whooped me. And he whooped me. And daughter, as if that wasn't enough, he turned round and burned my eyes out. At that instant, I began to cry. The tears were streaming down my cheeks. meeting under my chin. But he cautioned me. Mm-mm. Don't you cry for me now, daughter. Now you listen to me. I want you to promise me one thing. Promise me that you's gonna pick up every book you can and you's gonna read it from cover to cover. You see, today, daughter, ain't nobody gonna whip you or burn your eyes out 'cause you wanna learn to read. Promise me that you gonna go all the way through school as far as you can. And one more thing. I want you to promise me that you's gonna tell all the children my story. Papa Dallas survived slavery, and I kept my promise. I'm now a university professor, a PhD, and an actress. He and many others deserve to have their stories told. In the late 30s and early 40s, federal and private agencies sent interviewers across the South in an effort to document music and culture. Among those interviewed were African Americans like Papa Dallas, who had been born into slavery and lived through the Civil War. Many of the interviews were documented on paper. Some of the interviewers were able to record their voices. In this program, you will hear parts of these original recordings and dramatic readings of some of the written transcripts by actors Debbie Allen, Louis Gossett Jr., Esther Rolle, James Earl Jones, Clifton Davis, and others. And now, former slaves tell you in their own words of their lives in bondage and what it was like to be a slave no more.
My name is Fountain Hughes. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. And now I am 101 years old.
The Fountain Hughes interview was recorded in 1949. At that time, he had been living in Baltimore for about 40 years.
You talk about how old you are, Uncle Fountain. You,
well,
how far back do you remember?
Well, I tell you, things come to me in spells, you know. I remember things more when I'm laying down than I do when I'm standing, when I'm walking around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my boy days, boys lived quite different from the way they live now. Oh, you wore a dress like a woman till I was, I'd be 10, 12, 13 years old.
So you wore a dress, though?
Yes, I didn't wear no pants, and of course it didn't make boys' pants. Boys wore dresses. Well, the women wearing the pants now, and the boys wearing the dresses. Still.
Who did you work for, Uncle Fountain? When...
Who did I work for?
Yeah.
You mean when I was a slave?
Yeah, when you were a slave, who did you work for?
Well, I belonged to Burnley's. When I was a slave, my mother belonged to Burnley's, but we didn't know nothing. Didn't like to look at no book. And there were some freeborn colored people where they had little education, but there were very few of them where we was. And we all had a jail sentence, just same as we were in jail. Now, I couldn't go from here across the street, or I couldn't go to nobody's house without I have a note or something from my master. And if I had that pass, that was what we call a pass, if I had that pass, I could go wherever he sent me, and I'd have to be back, you know, whoever he sent me to. They'd give me another pass, and I'd bring that back so as to show how long I'd been gone. We couldn't go out and stay an hour or 2 hours or something like that. But they'd give me a note so there wouldn't nobody interfere with me and tell who I belonged to. And when I come back, well, I'd carry it to my master and give that to him. I'd be all right. But I couldn't just walk away like the people does now, you know. It was what they call, we were slaves. We belonged to people. They sell us like they sell horses and cows and hogs and all like that. Have an auction bench and they put you on up on the bench and bid on you the same as you're bidding on cattle, you know.
Was that in Charlotte that you were a slave? Was that in Charlotte or Charlottesville?
That was in Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Selling women, selling men. All that. And then if they had any bad ones, they'd sell them to the nigger traders, what they call the nigger traders, and they'd ship them down south to sell them down south. But otherwise, if you were a good person, they wouldn't sell you. But if you were bad and mean, they didn't want to beat you and knock you around, they'd sell you to the what they call a nigger trader. If that were regular. I was sailed every month, you know, at the courthouse. And then they'd sell you. Maybe $200, $100, $500.
Robert Glenn's father did his best to keep his family intact. He tried to purchase his son with the money he had earned. The distinguished actor James Earl Jones reads his words.
I was a slave before and during the Civil War. I am 87 years old. I was born September 16, 1850. I was born in Orange County, North Carolina, near Hillsboro. I belonged to a man named Bob Hall. He was a widower. He had three sons, Thomas, Nelson, and Lambert. He died when I was 8 years old, and I was put on the block and sold in Nelson Hall's yard by the son of Bob Hall. I saw my brother and sister sold on the same plantation. My mother belonged to the Halls, and father belonged to the Glens. They sold me away from my father and mother, and I was carried to the state of Kentucky. I was bought by a Negro speculator by the name of Henry Long, who lived not far from Hurdley Mill in Person County. I was not allowed to tell my mother and father goodbye. I was bought and sold three times in one day. My father's time was hired out, and he knew a trade. He had, by working overtime, saved up a considerable amount of money. After the speculator Henry Long bought me, mother went to father and pled with him to buy me from him and let the white folks hire me out. No slave could own a slave, so father got the consent and help of his owners to buy me, and they asked Long to put me on the block again. Long did so and named his price, but when he learned who had bid me off, he backed down. Later in the day, he put me on the block and named another price, much higher than the price formerly set. He was asked by the white folks to name his price for his bargain, and he did so. I was again put on the auction block, and father bought me in, putting up the cash. Long then flew into a rage, saying, "You think you are white, do you? Now just to show you are black, I will not let you have your son at any price." Father knew it was all off. Mother was frantic, but there was nothing they could do about it. They had to stand and see the speculator put me on his horse behind him and ride away without allowing either of them to tell me goodbye. I figure I was sold three times in one day. Mother was told, under threat of whooping, not to make any outcry when I was carried away. He took me to his home, but on the way he stopped for refreshments at a plantation, and while he was eating and drinking, he put me into a room where two white women were spinning flax. I was given a seat across the room from where they were working. After I had sat there a while, wondering where I was going and thinking about mother and home, I went over to one of the women and asked, "Missus, When will I see my mother again? She replied, I don't know, child. Go and sit down. I went back to my seat, and as I did, both the women stopped spinning for a moment, looked at each other, and one of them remarked, Almighty God, this slavery business is a horrible thing.
You're listening to Remembering Slavery, African Americans talking about their personal experiences of slavery and emancipation. Some of the tape is remastered recordings of actual interviews with former slaves done by writers with the Federal Writers Project in the early 1930s. Those tapes that could not be salvaged by the Library of Congress and the Smithsonian are read by actors who are reading the actual transcripts, actors like Debbie Allen and Clifton Davis, Lou Gossett, James Earl Jones, Jetta Jones, Melba Moore, and Esther Roll. We'll be back with this special today on the first working day of John Ashcroft, the new Attorney General of the United States. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the special production of a collaboration of the Smithsonian and Library of Congress, it's called Remembering Slavery, African Americans Talk About Their Personal Experiences of Slavery and Emancipation. Quite remarkable set of tapes, live recordings of interviews with former slaves, and dramatic readings by actors and other celebrities from written interviews. Remembering Slavery.
Mrs. R., this boy will never see his mother again. This remark nearly killed me as I began to fully realize my situation. Long, the Negro trader, soon came back, put me on his horse, and finished the trip to his home. He kept me at his home a while, and then traded me to a man named William Moore. Moore, at this time, was planning to move to Kentucky, which is what he did, taking me with him. Mother found out by the grapevine telegraph that I was going to be carried to Kentucky. She got permission and came to see me before they carried me off. When she started home, I was allowed to go part of the way with her, but they sent two Negro girls with us to ensure my return. We were allowed to talk privately, but while we were doing so, the two girls stood a short distance away and watched, as the master told them when they left that if I escaped, they would be whooped every day until I was caught. When the time of parting came, and I had to turn back, I burst out crying loud. I was so weak from sorrow, I could not walk. The two girls who were with me took me by each arm and led me along, half carrying me.
Now, I remember seeing a heap of slave sales. They's all in chains and the speculators selling and buying them off. I also remember seeing a drove of slaves with nothing on but a rag betwixt the legs being galloped round before the buyers.
Josephine Smith was 94 when interviewed in Raleigh, North Carolina. Her written transcript is read by Miss Debbie Allen.
But about the worst thing I ever see, though, it was a woman at Lewisburg who had been sold off from a 3-week-old baby. And she was being marched to New Orleans. She had walked till she was about give out and so weak enough to fall into the middle of the road. She was chained to 20 or 30 other slaves, and they stopped to rest in the shade of a big old oak tree while the speculators ate their dinner. Of course, slaves ain't had no dinner. And as I passed by, this woman begs me in God's name for a drink of water. Ooh, I gives it to her, too. I ain't never been so sorry for nobody. It was the month of August, and the sun was, burned down hot on the slaves and the drivers, and, well, when they leave the shade, they walk for a little piece, and this woman fall out. She dies right there at the side of the road, dead, just dead, right there. And right there they buries her, cussing. And they telling me about losing money on her. Oh, Lord Jesus, Lord, Lord have mercy.
Certain slaves were assigned to care for the children while the mothers worked. Laura Smalley describes this system on her plantation.
Just like, you know, you'd bring a whole lot of children, you know, and put them down, you know, at one house. Well, somebody have to look over them, you know, and tend to them that way. Just a house full of little children. Mm-hmm. And if one act bad, you know, they'd whoop him. They'd whoop him, too, the old woman. And if the old woman didn't tend to the children, they'd whoop her, too. You know, to make her attend to the children, she wasn't doing them, and they'd whoop her. And they had trees, and all of them, you know, would get around that tree with spoons and eat, such as like moisture soup or something like that. Would feed them, you know, before 12 o'clock. And all them children would get around there and just eat out of there. And that old woman, you know, she would tend to them. And they had certain times to come to them children. I think about this like a cow, I said, would go to the cave, you know. Uh-huh. You know, they had certain time. You know, cow come to his cave at night. Well, they come at 10 o'clock, every day, 10 o'clock, to all them babies. Them what nurse, you know. Uh-huh. Them what didn't nurse, they didn't come to them at all. The old lady fell. When that horn blew the horn for their mothers, you know. They just come just like cows. It's funny, you know, coming to the children.
In some cases, the parents of slaves were forced to helplessly witness their children being beaten by the masters. Former slave Caroline Hunter said in her interview, "During slavery, it seemed like your children belonged to everybody else but you. Many a day, my old mama has stood by and watched Marcia beat her children till they bled and she couldn't open her mouth. They ain't beat us, but they used to strap my mama to a bench or a box and beat her with a wooden paddle while she was naked." Throughout the hardships, slave families who were able to stay together found strength in one another. Growing up a slave in Virginia, Frank Bell was blessed to be surrounded by parents, grandparents, and others who shared work as well as living quarters. Louis Gossett Jr. portrays Frank Bell.
John Fallon's had about 150 servants. He wasn't much on no special house servants. But everybody in the field he did, even the women. Growed mostly wheat on the plantation, and the men would scythe and cradle, while the women folks would rake and bind. Then us little children, boys and girls, would come along and stack. Used to work in family groups, we did. Now me and my four brothers never had no sisters. Used to follow my mom and dad. In that way, one could help the other when they got behind. All of us would pitch in and help Mama, who wasn't very strong. Because in that way, the man, what was doing the cradling, would always go no faster than the woman, who was most times his wife, could keep up. Old overseer on some plantations wouldn't let families work together. But Marse John Fallons had a black foreman, what was my mother's brother, my uncle. Moses Bell was his name. And he always looked out for his kinfolk.
I was raised in the house with him.
Mr. Felix
McMillan. And they taught me mighty good. They teach me good.
Joe McDonald of Livingston, Alabama, spent his childhood in the big house with the white folks. The voice of Joe McDonald.
They said, I remember, said, Joe, I said, yes, sir. When we are dead and in heaven, they said, we want to raise you as an intelligent nigger. We want you to have good friends like we have got. Say, you'll never be scratched by good, rich, sensible white folks because they can tell who you are by your raising and your compliments. To show that you've been raised, he said, not by the colored, but by the white. I wash the nines. Some days I'd wash 100 pieces. Every morning I'd have 5 beds to make up, 5 fire snakes and the children to dress and churning to do. And after that, but then I'd have some parts of the day. But I had all that to do every day.
We ate twice a day, by sun up. And at sundown.
Mr. John Sawyer as Bailey Cunningham.
All the work hands ate in the cabins. And all the children took their soup bowls to the big kitchen and got it full of cabbage soup. Then we was allowed to go to the table where the white folks ate and get the crumbs from the table.
Now, if my master wanted to send me, he never said he couldn't get a horse and ride and walk.
Fountain Hughes.
You'd be barefooted and cold, but it didn't make no difference. You wasn't no more than a dog, some of them in them days. You wasn't treated as good as you treat dogs now.
On some plantations, beatings were rare or even forbidden. On others, they were unpredictable and dependent upon the temperament of overseers and slaveholders. Laura Smalley talks about one of the worst beatings she saw.
Well, they take that old woman, poor old woman, cat in the peach orchard, and whipped her. And, you know, just tied her hand this way, you know, around the peach orchard tree. I remember that just as well, looked like to me I can, and round a tree and whipped her. And well, she couldn't do nothing but just kick her feet, you know, just kick her feet. But it just had her clothes off down to her waist, you know. Just didn't have her plumb naked, but they had her clothes down to her waist. And every now and then they'd whip her, you know, and then snuff the pipe out on her, you know. She'd snuff the pipe out on her. You know, the embers in the pipe, and where you'll see the pipe smoking.
Blow them out on her?
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord, have mercy.
Did she scream? Yeah, I reckon she was. I reckon she did. But you see, we was dared to go out there, where it was, you know, because our old marshal would whoop us, and then Uncle Saul would whoop us. You see that an overseer, Uncle Saul. Her papa was overseer. But he had a whooper. And whooped her, too. And he sure did whoop her. Well, whipped her so then at night they'd have to grease her back. Grease her back. I don't know what kind of grease they had, but they sure grease her back. At night, you know, that way. Just grease her back. And so after they whipped her so long, they quit. They quitting. Give her dinner late that evening. They give her dinner. Eat late that night. Well, she so whooped so bad then, you know, she didn't want to eat, you know. If you put whoop you half a day, you ain't want to eat.
Right.
You call a little child, you can whoop a little child now. He'll get mad, you know, and don't want to eat nothing. So they whoop him. So Uncle Saul, then he'll go whoop my mama. We had a brother, the oldest brother named Cal. And he was going to whoop my mother's boy, Peg Water. And she was going to fight him.
Is that right?
Yes, sir. She was going to fight him. You see, one portion of the people belonged to Mr. Bethany, and one portion, you know, belonged to his wife. Wife, you know, just like, you know, You'd have a lot of niggas, you know, and they'd give you a portion of them, and your wife portion of them. Her people give you heap of them, and then your people give you some. Well, that makes two parts. You got a part, and your wife got a part, you know, or colored folks out of weight. And so Miss Adeline wouldn't let Uncle Saul whoop her. That was her side, you know, that's one of her niggas. She wouldn't let Uncle Saul whoop her that way. Well, then they called her a sassy nigga. Sassy called wouldn't let Uncle Saul whoop her about the boy packing water. You know, he packed water, you know, all day. And if Uncle Saul, if they stayed late, you know, and when they got to the water where Uncle Saul was, the overseer was, he just pitched it out. Just pitched it out. As fast as the children could get to her. And you know, she'd whoop him if they let him. Yes, he'd whoop him if they let him.
Whipping was not the only form of discipline practiced on plantations. Laura Smalley had a relative who was exempt from the lash, but punished in other ways.
Uncle Jesse, you know, he wasn't born, he wasn't one of Mr. Bethany's niggas. He was a Payne's. My old stepdad, yes, he was a Payne's. Yeah, he was a Payne's. And he'd do anything, you know, they couldn't whoop him. Couldn't whoop him. And his head was red, and he was red.
Well, where'd he come from?
Well, I think he come from Louisiana, somewhere. Anyhow, he come somewhere. I couldn't exactly tell where he come from, because my mama come from Mississippi. And when he back up, you know, I don't know where y'all ever see the corner fence.
Yes, sir, one of these rail fences.
Yes, sir, yes, sir. Yeah. Well, he'd back up in that, and they wouldn't whoop him. He'd get him a stick and keep him off. Yes, sir. And he's a great big old man, you know, and he wouldn't let them whoop him, you see. And then the master wouldn't let them hurt him, because he wouldn't let the overseer know they'd whoop you. The master make them whoop you for the overseer didn't feed them. And they wouldn't let him whoop them at all, wouldn't know. And the old master would tell him, rather than to kill him or something like that, don't hurt him. But don't kill him, you know, but whoop him. He wouldn't whoop him, I tell you. No, he wouldn't whoop him. No, sir, he wouldn't
whoop
him.
Well, how would they punish him then?
Give him a year of corn. Give him a year of corn. Just like, you know, you give me a year of corn, and that'll be for my dinner or my breakfast. When you come home to dinner, he said he'd give him a year of corn. Said he'd shell it off and plow along and eat it. Just plow along and eat it. Night come, they'd give him a year of corn. And that's the way they fed him, you know, punishing him, you know, wouldn't give him nothing to eat. And say, look like he was moving along too slow, too fast with that, you know, too good. Too good with that, you know, just giving him corn. And he's eating it, you know, and drinking water and going just the same. That's why they wouldn't give him none. Give him none. Wouldn't give him nothing, you know. But
you've been listening to Remembering Slavery, a Smithsonian and Library of Congress production. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The first ever World Social Forum summit has come to an end. Despite the astonishing attendance in Porto Alegre, Brazil, by some 16,000 social justice leaders from around the world, the summit received almost no media attention in the United States. The forum was conceived in response to the World Economic Forum, an annual meeting of CEOs and heads of state in Davos, Switzerland. That was taking place at the same time last week. The WEF allows multinational corporations direct access to the government decision makers who influence their industries and grants governments an unparalleled opportunity to coordinate their operations with global business. Participants at the Social Forum in Brazil sought to come up with alternatives to the WEF's corporate-led globalization. During the week-long summit, French farmer José Bovet, fellow activists, and more than 1,000 Brazilian landless peasants occupied a plant owned by U.S.-based Monsanto as they shouted that the bioengineered seeds means death to farmers. But Monsanto was able to run the farm in Brazil, saying it was experimental. Today, we're going to turn to an interview with Walden Bellow, director of Focus on the Global South, one of the leaders of the anti-corporate globalization movement. He was in Brazil for the conference and spoke with Mario Murillo, who produces the weekly national radio program Our Americas, produced with the North American Congress on Latin America, NACLA, and Pacifica. This is Walden Bellow, a Focus on the Global South, also a professor at the University of the Philippines.
We're here in Porto Alegre, of course, as we continue our coverage of the World Social Forum, the first World Social Forum, and we're here with a voice that is heard regularly on Pacifica Radio and on WBAI, Walden Bellow. Walden, you're here, of course, and I was hoping to get first your reaction to the significance of this Foro Social Mundial. What do you think of what's been going on here?
Well, I think it's been very impressive, and I think that the PT and the government of Rio Grande do Sul and of Porto Alegre really have performed a very vital function for the world in hosting this World Social Forum as a counterpoint to the meeting happening among the global elite in Davos. And I think that this is a very good beginning for thousands of people coming here, who are interested in changing and reversing the sort of extremely destructive process of globalization that's happening at this point. This gives me a lot of hope.
Now, it's held here in Brazil. I was wondering if you could perhaps look into Brazil and perhaps do a comparison with how Brazil has been impacted by globalization and with some of the other countries that you've studied over the years, perhaps specifically the Philippines.
Well, I think Brazil is impacted by globalization in the same way that the Philippines, in the sense that you have an elite that is growing ever richer geometrically, and a vast mass of people that are increasingly even more marginalized. This is a country that has the worst income distribution, I believe, in Latin America, or among the countries that has a very, very bad income distribution. I believe the Gini coefficient here reaches around 50. This is the same as in other countries in the area. In the world, in the third world, that have been impacted on by globalization, like the Philippines, like Thailand.
You talked at the panel that looked at IMF World Bank policies in the forum yesterday about how the structural adjustment policies have been implemented specifically around the debt, a debt that was accumulated under repressive regimes, much like here in Brazil and, again, much like the Philippines. Could you elaborate on that for our listeners?
I think that that basically I think what we've seen was during the big glory years of the 1970s and 1980s for a number of third world elites who went on a borrowing spree, and that was a borrowing spree that was also a lending spree by the big northern banks. It was a symbiotic process between elites that needed to lend and elites that needed to borrow. And what that created was this massive debt crisis. And that massive debt crisis, what happened was that there were two priorities that were pushed on third world countries at that point. One was repaying the debt, which means that national development rated a very poor third or fourth as a national priority compared to repaying the debt. And then the second thing that happened there was the World Bank and the IMF, pushed on by the elites of the United States, used the occasion to transform the economies of the South via structural adjustment, that is, reduce state intervention, reduce the role of the state in the economy, and create a strongly market-oriented, market-directed economies. Now, that process resulted in the institutionalization of stagnation in the third world. Economic growth has been a very erratic sort of thing. What we've seen instead has been an institutionalization of stagnation, increasing poverty and increasing inequality. So what we've seen, therefore, is that the debt has become a massive burden. It has hardly been reduced at all in the last few years. The debt has been repaid several times, yet because of extremely high interest rates, you know, it continues to be quite unsustainable. The economies are stagnant, and we see that at the end of the 20th century, poverty rates are going up, and the inequalities of income have been unparalleled in the last few decades. And of course, in the last 3 years, we have also seen that part of the world that seemed to be able to escape the sort of stagnation in Latin America and Africa, the Asian financial crisis laid low the tigers of Asia. They are now being in the process of being structurally adjusted by the IMF. You find stagnation in that region too, and you also find poverty and inequality rising. So the so-called Asian miracle also is over now. And developing countries, third world countries, are all caught up in the same vice of structural adjustment, rising debt, rising inequality, rising poverty that you found that you know, at this point in time. So Porto Alegre becomes a very important area or a very important event from which civil society and groups from all over the world can discuss and propose the alternatives to this unsustainable process.
One of the things, though, is if you watch, and I've been watching some of the coverage. Hold on, let me get this bell out of the way. One of the things that I've noticed in watching some of the coverage, you know, when I get home late this past few days, in CNN, for example, CNN in Espanol, is how they're looking at Davos, what's going on in Davos simultaneously to the World Social Forum here in Porto Alegre. And it's as if these issues that you're raising are almost non-existent. In other words, they cover some of the protests that are happening, but they're never couched in the terms that you just laid out. I mean, why do you suppose that, you know, somehow the World Bank and the IMF are kind of getting away with it, so to speak?
Well, I think that the media has treated this as as a study in contrast in very superficial terms. I think I haven't really been able to watch many of the programs that have come out recently since I've been so busy with this conference, but I think they're treating the whole thing quite superficially. Davos, the global elite getting together, Porto Alegre, social issues, and no structural connection between the massive wealth of the people in Davos. I think that if you average it out, probably the average income of people attending the Davos conference might probably come to between 10 to 20 million dollars, okay? And then you look at, I mean, if you include Bill Gates particularly in this equation, right? And then you look at the average income of the people attending the meeting here, and, you know, it would be quite much lower than that, you know? So I think that the media sort of does not get the does not push the structural connection, you know, between the issues that we're concerned with here and the conditions of the people that are attending the meeting in Davos and the sort of institutions that mediate this. And I think that it's largely a function of lack of information. It is ignorance. It is ideology. And of course, there's only, you can only go so far in reporting the realities in the biggest conglomerate merger that ever took place, which CNN is part of the AOL Time Warner merger, and it, you know, that institution is not about to start casting slurs on people like Steve Case and Levin, the head of Time Warner.
Certainly not a space for self or auto scrutiny, that's for sure. But with that in mind, some of the proposals that you've put forward, and you, based on information and based on research and based on the things that you were saying that mass media perhaps do not have, you've made some proposals that would be perceived in those same mass media as somewhat radical. For example, the termination, the abolishment of some of these same institutions, the World Bank, et cetera, the IMF. Could you talk about what you think needs to be done?
Well, I think some of the proposals that I make are not really that radical at this point in time. I think the sense that the World Trade Organization is really a straitjacket is something that is shared even by people within governments in the South. They're very, very upset that the WTO in the last 5 years, instead of helping bring about the promise of liberalized trade, bringing about greater prosperity, has in fact worsened the conditions for a third world country. So I think third world technocrats, third world governments are very upset over the directions of the WTO. In terms of the World Bank and the IMF, what can I say except that the Meltzer Commission, which, you know, was this conservative liberal commission mandated by the U.S. Congress to look at the record of the World Bank and the IMF. I mean, that commission itself has proposed the practical dismantling of the World Bank and the radical reduction of the role of the IMF, you know, for many of the same reasons that we have said, and for other reasons as well that we may not be in agreement with. But nevertheless, I think that the sort of radical disempowerment of the WTO, the dismantling of the IMF, the dismantling of the World Bank, I think are much more acceptable now than they were, say, even just 2 years ago. So I think what used to be something called radical is fast becoming mainstream.
How much do you think it has to do with the mobilizations that have been going on around the world?
Of course. I mean, I think the mobilizations, politics is always important. If the 50,000 people were not in Seattle and helped precipitate the collapse of the Seattle summit, I think that the sort of impregnable image of many of these institutions would continue to hold. But something happened in Seattle that was then followed up with increasing loss of confidence in confrontations with masses of people in Washington in April, in Melbourne in September, in Chiang Mai, Thailand in May, and then Prague during the IMF World Bank meeting. There is an increasing loss of confidence and loss of the legitimacy of these institutions. Even the global elite is beginning to lose tremendous loss of confidence in the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank as mechanisms to push their interests. So,
Walden Bello is director of Focus on the Global South and professor at University of the Philippines. speaking to Pacifica producer Mario Maggio in Porto Alegre, Brazil, this past week, where the World Social Forum took place of more than 16,000 social justice leaders. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Our engineer is Anthony Sloan. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!